This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Katie Coldiron, and I have the pleasure today to be interviewing Alina Van Omen, author of Nicaragua Must Survive, Sandinista Revolutionary Diplomacy and the Global Cold War, released late last year from the University of California Press. Alina is lecturer in contemporary history at the University of Leeds. Thank you so much for being with us today, Alina.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what I like to start off these podcasts with is just asking the authors, how did this work really come to be?
Yeah, with this kind of question, you always kind of look back at your own past and you all make it into one coherent narrative. And I just wanted to start off by saying, like, it wasn't like that. Like, I never thought I would have written this book, and I could have gone, I think, in many different directions. But so to create that narrative, then, I guess, looking back, it started for me in Groningen. This is my hometown, the city, a city in the Netherlands where I grew up and where I also studied for my undergrad history. And there I took a course called Project for the World. And it was about kind of the hopes and aspirations of peoples in the global south to create this kind of better world order, more equal, more just. And then I wrote an essay about Che Guevara and him going to the Congo and failing to start a revolution there. And it wasn't a great essay, I think, but it really sparked, like, it was the start of kind of this journey. And then when I went to London, I went to the LSE for my master's, and I was more interested in Latin American history. And there I met Tanya Harmer, and she kind of was really a source of inspiration. And then I wrote my master's dissertation about the Nicaraguan Revolution and its impact in the Netherlands. And that was really about kind of the solidarity activist in the Netherlands that supported the revolution. And it was nice, but then in the archive, and I did most of my research in the International Institute of Social History in Amsterdam, I just came across a lot of letters from the FSLN and from quite high-ranking kind of Sandinista officials. And it was just a surprise to me because I thought, why? Why would these kind of important figures in Nicaragua and the revolution, like, be interested in these non-state groups, these kind of small left-wing organizations in the Netherlands? And then I realized, to kind of answer this question, I need to kind of go to Nicaragua and I need to kind of place this kind of particular Dutch story into this broader history of the Sandinistas' revolutionary diplomacy. So that really got me started with the book.
Thank you so much for that. A very interesting origin story. And I love when work is guided by what you're finding in the archives. So as an archivist myself. So moving on, a key theme throughout the book is the idea of revolutionary diplomacy, obviously, which you trace from the struggle and ultimate success of the Nicaraguan Revolution to 1990, when democratic elections ultimately oust FSO and leader Daniel Ortega from power. So what I want to ask you is, what does revolutionary diplomacy mean, and how did the concept change throughout the post-Somoza years up until 1990?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, the idea of the concept or the idea of revolutionary diplomacy is really what I use to describe the foreign policy of the FSLN, of the Sandinistas, and of both before the 1979 victory and after. And I use it because I think, even though the FSLN was inspired by like earlier examples of revolutionary diplomacy in Cuba or the Palestine Liberation Organization or Algeria, their foreign diplomacy or the revolutionary diplomacy was in many ways very unique and special. So in a way, it was them changing, wanting to change the world. So it was not just kind of normal day-to-day diplomacy to get by, so to say. It was really also an attempt to create a revolutionary world. So what they saw as their own revolution was the beginning of many more revolutions. So in that sense, it was about creating a new world order. So there was that ambition there. And obviously, when they are still a revolutionary movement, so not in power, they employ this unique kind of global strategy to make the revolution a success. And that works out really well, because for a long time, even in the 70s, the FSLN is kind of a small, isolated group of guerrillas in the mountains. But that changes rather quickly when they start to launch this global revolutionary diplomacy, which is really targeted towards making them appear more kind of acceptable in a way to more moderate groups. So they kind of consciously make the decision to claim that we are not like another Latin American group of left-wing guerrillas like the Cubans. We are different. We are like, we're building a new sort of revolution. We're fighting for, well, they tailored their message towards their audience, but we're fighting for either democracy or we're fighting for human rights. But they really used this revolutionary diplomacy to make them appear to the international community as the legitimate representative of the Nicaraguan government. And before coming to power, that is in a way relatively easy, because their main message is, we are anti-Somoza. So we want to get rid of this dictator that is violating human rights. And to do so, they build connections with states, but also, and that's a part of the book, with these transnational activists that they then use to spread awareness about the revolution, but also to get money, to buy weapons. And then when they come to power, that shifts, obviously, because then they're suddenly in power, they're in charge of a state, and their priorities change, which makes sense. They need to build a new foreign government, a foreign civil service. They need money. So they're focusing more, especially in the beginning, on building relations with governments who actually can provide them with that money, which is Western European governments, but also Latin American governments, also in the Soviet Union, Soviet bloc. And then these solidarity activists are not necessarily always appreciative of that in the early years, because they are used to this kind of relationship between equals in a way. Before the revolution, the Sandinista representative would just come. They would often stay at people's houses in Europe. It was more, they went to the pub. Like, they had, like, it felt, especially to these activists, as an equal one. And then suddenly they're in power. And then there's an episode in the book when they come. I forgot who exactly was. Sergio Ramirez was definitely there, and they come and they expect to meet with high-ranking government officials, but the activists are more, they have their own, like, they brought their own car, and the Sandinistas is like, we need an official car. And it's like, they have to really explain, like, we are no longer on kind of equal footing, as they say. So the way revolutionary diplomacy is implemented and the way the Sandinistas use it changes when they come to power. And it changes further throughout the 1980s as well, because they basically need to get more defensive. So rather soon in the early 1980s, this kind of hopes of a new world order, they disappear, and the Stalinists have to focus more on the defense of the revolution, which is obviously under increasing pressure by the United States. When Reagan comes to power, the Contra War starts. There's economic problems because of U.S. pressure, but also because there is the debt crisis going on, like global financial crisis. So their revolutionary diplomacy becomes more about survival, hence the title of the book, Nicaragua Must Survive. And then in the late 1980s, which is a bit ironic, but the Sandinista revolutionary diplomacy, I argue in the book as well, is a success because of the Cold War framework, because the Sandinistas very smartly and strategically use the Cold War framework to their own advantage by constantly saying that either transcending the Cold War, so saying actually, if to the Western Europeans, if you don't provide us with aid, we would be forced to turn to the East, or also by using this kind of Cold War non-alignment narrative to get support as well, by saying we're actually, what's happening here has nothing to do with the Cold War, but because so many people are disillusioned by the Cold War at that time in the early 1980s, that actually appeals. But then in the late 1980s, when these kind of Cold War tensions decline, that argument that loses its potency, because the Europe, when they say, well, we need financial aid, the Europeans can just say, well, you can really no longer turn to the Soviet Union because they're no longer providing you with financial aid. So why would we? So then the revolutionary diplomacy kind of becomes a lot less successful, and it falls into less fertile ground as the Cold War comes to an end as well.
Thank you so much for that. So I'm glad you brought up the Cold War framework, because that leads into the next question. Obviously, as this is a Cold War era story, the roles of the superpowers are important, but they aren't most of the story in this work. So if you could, you already alluded to this a little bit, could you tell us a little bit more about the roles of the Soviet Union and the United States in this story, and also why you ultimately focus more on Western Europe?
Yes, of course. So I just want to start out by saying, like, my choice to focus on Western Europe is not saying that, like, the superpowers didn't matter, obviously. And there have also been already some brilliant books on, for instance, the United States' role in Central America, and also about the United States solidarity by Roger Peace, for instance, and Michael William Smeatley has written an excellent book about Reagan's foreign policy towards Nicaragua. So that all matters. So to briefly explain what the U.S. role. You had three presidencies during the Sandinista Revolution. So obviously it was Carter first, and then you had Reagan, and then Bush in the revolution's final years. And the main thing to mention here, that Carter's kind of human rights policy was kind of mixed in a way. So in the beginning, he's quite critical of Somoza, but then when kind of push comes to shove and the danger of the FSLN taking over becomes clear, and then the Carter administration also, for instance, writes to the European government saying that they should not support the FSLN, and he kind of, so it's kind of a mixed bag there. But then the Sandinistas come to power, and very soon after, Reagan comes to power. And he is very clearly, like, against what the Sandinistas are trying to achieve. And also they consider Central America to be very important. So there's the famous quote by Jean Kirkpatrick that Central America is just the most important place in the world right now. And that's, I think, very clear in the United States foreign policy. So Reagan puts a lot of economic pressure on the Sandinista government, but he also provides the counter-insurgents, counter-revolutionaries with financial aid and support and political backing. Like, he presents them as freedom fighters. So I just want to briefly say now that on the one hand, obviously, there is the whole narrative that all the Contras, all those who opposed the Sandinistas were CIA-backed and CIA puppets, which is not the case. Like, we all know now about, like, people who are genuinely disillusioned with the Sandinistas. We know about the Miskito Coast and the indigenous struggle against the Sandinista government, which is not very deeply covered in the book, but is important to mention here. So now the scholarship is kind of, both were there. So there was nationalist, genuine resentment against the FSLN, but there was also the CIA, and the contrast wouldn't have been as strong as it wasn't for the United States military support for them. And then that's basically the US role. They try to isolate the Sandinistas, they put pressure on the Sandinistas, and they hope that they will lose power. When Bush then comes to power, that strategy shifts a bit, because then he's more willing to back the idea that the FSLN would lose power in elections. And then we obviously don't know what would have happened if the FSLN would have won the 1990 elections, because Bush doesn't, he continues to support the Contras until the elections. But his position was quite different, because there was the option of the Sandinistas staying in power, which wasn't really the case under Reagan. So that's, in a nutshell, is the US role. And then the Soviet Union, we know a bit less about, but there is some research being done. And I also did research in the East German archives, which gives us a bit of insight in the Soviet Union's role. And what we know is that until the revolution triumphs, the Soviet Union is basically, they're not involved. But then they obviously welcome it, because they see that this is something that the US is going to help them in the Cold War context. And throughout the 1980s, they do give the Sandinistas military support and financial aid, provide advice as well. But there's always some reluctance, also because of kind of financial issues within the Soviet Union itself. Also because they are a bit suspicious of the Sandinistas, like, revolutionary zeal, if they are actually like the Cubans. So, and it's definitely the Cubans who played a more active role in supporting the Sandinistas, and it's the Cubans as well who kind of pushed the Soviet Union to back the FSLN. So I would say definitely the Cuban government is more important here. So in this kind of Cold War context and with these major players, why do I focus mostly on Western Europe in the book? And I think the key reason for me is that it shows more than anything else is kind of the ingenuity and the creativity of the Sandinistas' revolutionary diplomacy. It really highlights how kind of pragmatic and smart they were in trying to protect the revolution. And it's also because it shows the revolution's global impact. So a lot of kind of these Cold War histories of Latin America have kind of an inter-American framework focused mostly on the Americas. And I think in my book, by focusing on Western Europe, I show that this was actually much more global, and that Latin Americans had an impact beyond the Western Hemisphere. While Europe wasn't the biggest player, it mattered so much for the FSLN as well, because they believed that this European involvement could kind of tip the inter-American balance in their favor. So that's why I think the focus on Europe here really highlights a surprising element of the Sandinistas' revolutionary diplomacy.
Thank you so much for that. So kind of you've already alluded to this a bit, but what were the Western European government's role in the Nicaraguan Revolution from its rise to its ultimate decline?
Yeah, great question. So before kind of getting into the role, just briefly, so you had Western Europe, but you had the European community as well. So that initially was 9 Western European states, but then Greece joined in 1981, and in 1986, Spain and Portugal also joined. So then you have the 12 European community states. And throughout the 1980s and the 70s, they coordinate parts of their foreign policy towards this kind of framework called European political cooperation. Very exciting. But so, and this kind of Western Europe, so the Western Europeans, when I talk about Western European foreign policy, I mean that the Western Europeans, like, they did have one coordinated foreign policy. There was also bilateral relations, and I talk about it in the book as well, but this kind of Western European initiative was truly a European initiative, Western European initiative. So in the lead up to the revolution, the Sandinistas reach out to Western European governments, and they say, well, we're fighting here, it's not a Cold War struggle, and you can, by supporting us, also make sure that this is not going to become a Cold War struggle. And the Western Europeans are excited about that, because they think that by supporting the Sandinistas, or by supporting the anti-Somoza opposition, they can make sure that there won't be a second Cuba, basically. So they think of what happened to the Cuban Revolution and how Cuba essentially became isolated, and they say, if we support the Sandinistas now, or the anti-Somoza movement now, we can prevent this from happening, and we can have an influence on the future of the revolution. They kind of want to have a moderating influence. So that's what they're trying to do by saying that Somoza should go, and also immediately after the revolution's victory, by sending lots of financial support, for instance, supporting the literacy campaign, really hoping to influence the trajectory of the revolution and making it kind of a third way. So the Socialist International is very heavily involved there as well. And especially in the early 80s, these are governments that are also in power. So the Social Democratic parties are in power in a couple European countries. And then beyond supporting the Nicaraguan Revolution, throughout the 1980s, from the mid, fairly quickly, actually, there's quite some disillusionment that actually there's no way we can actually influence directly what's happening in Nicaragua. But they are very concerned about the United States' role, and they are very concerned about what is happening in Central America having a negative impact on the global Cold War. So especially the West Germans, they're very worried that the Soviet Union can use what's happening in Central America as a means to prevent, like, weapons being redeployed in Europe. So they see this in a really global Cold War framework, and they worry that Central America can be used as a pawn against them in this kind of global Cold War game. And they think that Reagan is making this worse by militarizing the situation. So what they then do is support Latin American initiative to find a different solution, and particularly this idea that not the Cold War, but economic and social problems are behind this violence. So that's what they do, and it's a big deal, because in 1984, this is the first time, because this is a conference in Costa Rica where all these European foreign ministers come together with Latin American foreign ministers, and this is the first time that Western European or the European community participates in an event outside of Europe. So it really shows the importance of Central America in the 1980s as well on a global scale. So what the Europeans hope to achieve is basically by lending diplomatic and some financial support to this multilateral diplomatic initiative to weaken Reagan's foreign policy. But I do want to say that even though they disagreed with Reagan's methods, they did kind of agree with his ultimate aims. So they weren't necessarily supportive of the Sandinistas. So it's kind of, yeah, they wanted to weaken this kind of radical left, but to different means. And in the end, that worked out quite well for them. Kind of good cop, bad cop strategy almost, even though it wasn't coordinated.
Thank you so much for that. So, obviously, moving beyond the role of governments, you focus a lot on solidarity groups and activists, particularly Western Europeans. And as you show, and you've already alluded to, the relationship with the Sandinista government and these groups was not always smooth. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about this phenomenon, and particularly this relationship that seems to always be in flux.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So, yeah, one of the things that I argue in the book that is really unique about the Sandinistas' revolutionary diplomacy is that they did not just target governments, but they had this kind of, and they coordinated this transnational network of solidarity activists. So there were different solidarity committees in different countries, and all of these were united in a European network, and that was part of a global network. And they received direct instructions from the FSLM about campaigns. So this was really, this one was not just spontaneous outbursts of solidarity. This was part of their global, the Sandinistas' global strategy. And this worked out well. And I mean, these activists, they were keen to support the revolution. They were keen to support the Sandinistas. So one quite successful example is, for instance, the literacy campaign, which was in 1980. And because of the fundraising by activists, the FSLM was able to fund that literacy campaign. And then in 1983 as well, there were the Brigadistas, these people who went to Nicaragua to support the revolution, to help with coffee picking, even though they weren't always as good at that, at coffee picking. But they were there, and it showed support. And when they came back, they continued with their solidarity work. But there were also some tensions. And I think it stems from a sentiment, a feeling that the FSLN also encouraged, and that's that these people were part of the revolution as well. So in order to mobilize international support, the FSLN created this kind of feeling of an international revolutionary family. But then the FSLN also sometimes needed concrete support. So there was, for instance, the Nicaragua Must Survive campaign, which is basically that the FSLN wanted money and goods. And these activists were not necessarily that enthusiastic about the idea of just doing more fundraising. They actually wanted to go to Nicaragua. They wanted to participate directly, and they wanted to kind of have ownership over a project that wasn't ultimately their own. So efforts by the Sandinistas to centralize the solidarity movement, they were sometimes actively resisted by the activists, who kept saying they wanted to move more political work instead of humanitarian work. And they preferred these kind of more intimate one relationships with, for instance, Nicaraguan cities. So that's kind of related to the growth of the sister cities, links that existed in the 80s. It was also a means, in a way, to bypass the Sandinista central role by establishing direct connections with Nicaraguan towns, but also schools or like fishing cooperatives. Like, there were all sorts of connections that existed at the time. Which were not necessarily unhelpful for the Sandinistas, but also, if they wanted to coordinate their revolutionary diplomacy more directly, it made it difficult because it was less centralized than it could have been. So that those were some of the tensions that existed.
Thank you so much for that. So moving on, the diplomatic relationship between Nicaragua and its Central American neighbors is an important piece of this work. As you highlight such regional initiatives as the Contadora process and the Esquipo Las Dos peace accords, what were these initiatives and how did they factor into the diplomatic strategy of the Sandinista government?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, because we haven't really talked about the Latin American story there before. And so there's a great article and there's a great book coming out by Mateo Jaquin. Obviously, he looks more at the Latin American side of the story. But I cover it in the book as well. But then, so Contadora was a Latin American initiative, which was targeted towards finding Latin American solutions for Latin American problems, as they would say. And it was basically a challenge as well to Reagan's foreign policy, because it did not exclude the Sandinistas. So basically, the Sandinistas as a part of regional negotiations, hoping to find a solution to this crisis in the region. And that was good news for the Sandinistas, because they didn't want to be isolated. So the Sandinistas went along with these Contadora initiatives because it provided them with legitimacy, with platform. So that was good news, because that delegitimized Reagan's foreign policy. And it's also one of the key claims of Contadora was that, again, the socioeconomic inequalities were the reason for the violence and not the Cold War interference. So that worked out well for the FSLN. And then ultimately Contadora failed, in part because of US resistance to Contadora. So for instance, when the FSLN said they would sign the Contadora Act in 1984, immediately, like, there was this massive campaign to make sure that wasn't gonna put go forward. But in the end, I think the Sandinistas weren't that hopeful for Contadora to succeed either. For them, it was a means to present themselves in a good light on a global scale. But that was different with Esquipulas, because Esquipulas was a Central American initiative that followed on from Contador, somewhere in the late 1980s. And then in 1987, there was a successful Esquipulas meeting with the five Central American presidents when they commit to kind of bringing peace. And it was a bit different from Contador in that it focused also on not just on arms and outside interference, but also on democratization. And that was kind of meddling in internal affairs, which is what the FSLN first did not want. But then in the late 1980s, when the situation just got basically worse, the FSLN didn't have much options, so they went along with Esquipulas. So this was, and that was, it was a good option, but it was also the only option. And as I say in the book as well, like, the other Central American countries that were very critical of the Sandinistas, they could profit from that because the FSLN needed Esquipulas. So within the Esquipulas framework, they could be pressure on Nicaragua, and the spotlight was continuously on Nicaragua. But it did mean that the revolution had a chance to survive, because again, it meant that that there was a rejection of the United States' more military foreign policy. And the Europeans basically backed those initiatives. So again, this was kind of a Latin American initiative with European backing that did mean a rejection of United States' power in the region, which is why it was great for the FSLN. But it did mean that the FSLN had to make concessions regarding democracy, but also regarding negotiations with the Contras, for instance, something they initially refused to do.
Thanks so much. So you already mentioned this or alluded to it. And as someone who does Cuba, this probably explains why I have this question. As a reader, I was particularly surprised to read a book about a Cold War era left-wing Latin American government that mentioned Cuba sparingly, as this book did. So I really wanted to ask you about what the role of Cuba was in the diplomatic choices that the Sandinista government ultimately made, as well as kind of outsider imaginings. Like, for example, you use the language of brigadista for Europeans going to Cuba. There were plenty of brigadistas that went to Cuba as well. The outsider imaginings of what Sandinistas sought to implement in Nicaragua.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So yeah, Cuba is not as present in the book. It is present. I went to like the Cuban Foreign Ministry archives as well, and those were really useful. But I think when I started the research and I went to Nicaragua, the first thing that most people I interviewed told me is just like, well, we were independent. Like the Cubans were there, but we made the decision. So that was something that they continuously stressed. And actually, looking back, that surprised me a little bit, because I never really thought otherwise. But it was interesting that they felt the need to like remind me of that. And I mean, Emily Snyder has written like excellent works on like the Cuban-Nicaraguan relationship as well. And that shows, and the Cuban archives show, that this is just an intimate relationship. So the Cuban Foreign Ministry and the Nicaraguan Foreign Ministry, they collaborated closely, but also the way the Cubans trained Nicaraguan diplomats, the Nicaraguan Foreign Ministry was very much modeled on the Cuban model there. And so this was an intimate relationship. But also, obviously, the Cubans were kind of financially limited in what they could provide. And for me, this wasn't particularly surprising that the Cubans would support the Sandinistas. This was like what you would expect, like you expected it as well. And but I think before the revolution succeeded, there were more struggles, military struggles going on. And it took a while before the FSLN, or before it became clear that the FSLN could actually triumph, that they could actually defeat Somoza. So there, I think in the beginning, it was the Sandinistas themselves that developed that international strategy. But then Fidel Castro and the Cubans obviously played a big role in uniting these FSLN factions and also advising the Sandinistas about what to do and avoid kind of how they would would say that's all the mistakes that they made in the past. So there's one section in the book where I talk about this Eddie Cool, who travels to Europe and he meets the Cuban ambassador in Denmark, if I'm not mistaken, or Sweden, I don't remember. And he says, like, okay, make sure that you build relationships and that you don't become isolated as we did. So kind of memories of what happened to the Cuban Revolution also shape Nicaraguan foreign policy. So in that way, I think Cuba is very present in the book, because it similarly, it really informs the way the Western Europeans behave, because constantly the language of also the fear of the Cuban Missile Crisis repeating itself, but also of Nicaragua becoming isolated. So kind of the specter of the Cuban Revolution is definitely there. And then, sorry, I forgot, what was the other part of the question about?
So also like outsider imaginings of what the Sandinistas sought to implement in Nicaragua and how Cuba impacted those.
Yeah, so specifically on the Brigadistas. So I didn't come across like many direct reference to people going to Cuba. The only like clear one was obviously the literacy crusade, which was like Fernando Cardenal, and after they went to Cuba to look at like the museum there and to look at how the Cubans like did their literacy campaign. So that was like directly inspired by the Cuban Revolution, and this kind of the difference obviously was the Nicaraguan one had this Christian. It was called a literacy crusade, not a campaign. So in the Nicaraguan Revolution, there was much more this kind of liberation theology present than in the Cuban Revolution.
Very interesting. So obviously you've talked about foreigners going to Nicaragua quite a bit, so I won't ask you about that again. But you do also have multiple instances in the book of Nicaraguan government representatives going to Europe to speak to solidarity groups. So could you tell us a little bit more about this phenomenon of Nicaraguan representatives going out and doing this type of outreach?
Yeah, of course. So in the book's first chapter, you obviously have Nicaraguan exiles living in Europe, right? But not all of them are exiles. Some are also just students. And then they play key roles in setting up this transnational solidarity network. So Enrique Schmidt is a key figure. And he was based in West Germany, and he was part of the Chile solidarity movement there, but then he kind of pushes people towards creating Nicaragua solidarity committees. And then together with Angel Barajón is a Spanish priest, and he lived in Nicaragua, but then because of Somoza, he went back to Spain, and he played a big role in creating this transnational network as well. So these Nicaraguan exiles and Nicaraguan exchange students or foreign exchange students, they play a big role in the initial setting up of the network, particularly by just uniting, traveling around and putting people in touch with each other and really creating these European conferences where people could meet and coordinate. But then obviously when the revolution triumphed, they don't want to stay in Europe. They go back to Nicaragua. And then there is a bit of a vacuum because there are no Nicaraguan representatives to speak to. And then in the 80s, what we see is just quite often like quite high-ranking Nicaraguan officials traveling to Western Europe and doing these tours. So one famous visit is obviously when Daniel Ortega goes to the Soviet Union, and there's massive outcry, and then he realizes, oh, better go to Western Europe as well. So he kind of combines his Eastern European tour with visits to Western Europe. But what we also often see is that they send Sergio Ramirez, who was kind of more the civilian figure in the government, to Western Europe, while Thomas Borger, for instance, went to the East at the same time. And then they refer to each other's trips. So they use, again, this Cold War framework to create support for the revolution.
Thanks so much for that. So moving on, the choice by the Sandinista government to hold elections, which also differentiates it from like the Cuba case, for example, in 1984 and 1990 factor largely into the story. So I was wanting to ask you from a diplomatic standpoint, why these elections were held, as well as the differences between the two.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So Yeah, there were two elections, 1984 and 1990. There were lots of similarities between them, but also differences. I think before like going into that, a key thing to say is that before the 84 election, it was very clear that the Sandinistas believed that in a different form of democracy, not kind of the Western Reagan style, like democracy is elections and freedom of the press. They had like this idea of participatory democracy. They constantly said like the people have already made their choice with blood. So it was different. It was the idea of like continuously talking and influencing the revolution from below. So that was the idea. So the idea of holding elections was something that the West really pushed for, but it's something that says that did not necessarily want. But then after the invasion of Grenada in 1983, like fears of kind of US intervention or the war escalating run really high, and then there is this sense that they need to make concessions basically, and organizing elections is one of them. So they organize these elections as kind of to show the international environment this is a legitimate revolution, this is kind of a seal of approval. So but in 1984 that doesn't really succeed, that doesn't really work as they wanted to. So it was even though they invited like observers from around the world to observe the elections, and some countries did send observers like the Netherlands for instance, but even those observers, when they produced reports that were quite positive, governments would still say, well, that's not really representative, like these weren't really fair and free elections. And they say that even like, you know, in the months leading up to the elections already, so particularly the US government is really of the view that because this is a Marxist-Leninist state, there just can't be real democracy because these are mutually exclusive. And Michael William Smith has written an excellent book about, like, writes about that in his book as well, about democracy promotion and how this kind of specific US view of democracy really makes sure that the Sandinistas can never be seen as democratic there. And then as well in 1984, the main opposition party, they pull out of the elections and they cite that these are not taking place in a free, fair, like open environment. So they ultimately, these 1984 elections, they do not achieve their objective of creating more legitimacy, even though they're not like fully rejected everywhere, but it's more, yeah, they would have hoped for more basically, especially because they were hoping for more financial aid after the elections, and that just doesn't really happen. And then 1990 elections are different because they, first of all, they take place within this Esquipulas framework. So they're a concession that the Sandinistas make to their Central American neighbors, organizing elections. Reagan is no longer in power, but Bush is. And but like the 1984 elections, these are also, again, for the international seal of approval. So the FSLN puts in a lot of effort to convince the international environment that these are open and fair and honest elections. And that seems to work because there is increasingly kind of a consensus that even though things are not perfect in Nicaragua, these elections tend to be free and fair. And one of the reasons that more kind of right-wing governments are willing to say that is also because they believe, not like they're not too optimistic, but there is some hope that the UNO, the opposition coalition led by Violeta Chamorro, can actually win here. So there weren't opinion polls in Nicaragua, but they did some like secret ones and they were quite optimistic. But the solidarity movements and the Sandinistas and the Soviet Union, the Cubans, they really did, they were fully convinced that the FSLN would easily win. So because of that, that was, I think, if the elections would have gone differently, then there was a real chance that there would be the international legitimacy that the Sandinistas were fighting for since 1979. But that doesn't happen because they lose these elections. Particularly, I think, because the economic situation on the ground is just fully different and fully escalated. And in 84, there was still hope for Western European aid, but now, as I mentioned already, there was very little aid being given to Nicaragua because people were waiting, well, let's wait until after the elections before decisions are made. So the economic situation doesn't improve. Similarly, the Contra War, while since 1988 is not like as present, the Contras are not demobilized. So there's a constant fear of the war kind of escalating again. The military draft is, I think, still in place. So I think the idea that life is going to improve under further FSLN rule is just kind of gone by that time. So that's the kind of the end of the story there.
Thanks so much for that. So following electoral defeat, what does the FSLN look like in Nicaragua?
So obviously, immediately following the election, there's a lot of internal debate. So there is a peaceful transfer of power. Chamorro takes over. And with the FSLN, there is quite soon, there is a split. So on the one hand, you have Sergio Ramirez, who kind of moves toward the social democratic Sandinista movement, the Movimiento Renovador Sandinista. And then you have the FSLN, which is increasingly led by Ortega. And they come back to power in 2006-07. And are in power still. And then obviously, as I say in the book's conclusion as well, like in 2018, there's popular protests and against the Sandinista government, and it heavily cracks down. Like hundreds of people are killed by the police. So it's become increasingly authoritarian. But I haven't done like the primary resource. I'm not an expert on like post-1990 Nicaragua, but I was there for the final bit of my research when that happened.
Thanks so much for that. Really contextualizes today the situation in Nicaragua as well. So in your conclusion, you point out that the government led by the FSLN survived longer than Salvador Allende's government in Chile, and that mm-hmm. Nicaragua ultimately did not face an invasion from the U.S. like Grenada in 83 or Panama in 89. So I really wanted to ask you, kind of in your view, why is it that Nicaragua, alluding to your title, survived longer than these other cases?
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, I think that really goes to the heart of the book's key argument, and that is because of the Sandinistas' revolutionary diplomacy, the revolution survived for as long as it did. And I think, we shouldn't underestimate like the global impact that the revolution had and the popularity. I think I emailed like colleagues within like the humanities here about my book talk a while back. And I got like three emails back from people saying, oh, Nicaragua, I was there in the 1980s. Like, I think I wasn't alive then, but I think at that time, like, it was like the cause that people associated with, like people had posters, Nicaragua mugs, Nicaragua must survive, was like, it was present. And I think that had a lot to do with the revolution survival, that it was so popular and it had such a global impact. And that makes it, I mean, there are many other differences with Chile and Grenada and Panama, obviously. Like the Sandinistas, unlike Allende, they had power. Oh, they had the army. The U.S. played a very different role. I think Reagan's kind of hostile and aggressive policy helped to popularize the Sandinistas abroad. Because this, I mean, we haven't talked about the peace movement, for instance, but there was so much kind of fear of Reagan kind of basically starting the Cold War anew and nuclear war, that this kind of idea that what he was doing in Central America was just another one of his like weird, dangerous foreign policies with deathly consequences. So that narrative was really powerful, and that fear was really real. So that was obviously different. And then, I mean, there was no Panama Canal in Nicaragua, so it was less in that sense relevant in terms of security. It wasn't an island like Grenada, so there were all these kind of other factors. But I think the key thing is that the Sandinistas did implement that pragmatic foreign policy, that they were so creative, the cultural appeal of the revolution, and how they were able to mobilize that. And link that to similar foreign policies, because foreign governments took that into account. They took the popularity of the Sandinistas into account when formulating a foreign policy. And in the end, the Cold War as well was, as many have said, like, it was a struggle of a heart and mind. And that struggle for a long time was definitely won by the revolutionaries.
Thanks so much for that. So I always like to conclude by asking the authors a bit about what they're currently working on. So if you have any projects that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear about them.
Yeah, so I'm starting a new project, which I hope is going to be on the Central American peace process. So I want to kind of, I just noticed that there is a lot of rather triumphant Cold War IR literature about the peace process and how it ended the civil wars, but also a whole fascinating literature on violence in contemporary Latin America, and that actually the peace process didn't bring the peace. So I would just like to write kind of a history of that period, just not just focusing on Nicaragua, but also hopefully on El Salvador and Guatemala, and kind of the end of the Cold War and what it meant on the ground, as well as kind of looking at international organizations, such as the UN involvement there. But it's very early days.
Well, I think I speak for everybody when we say we're looking forward to seeing the fruit of that research. So thank you again. This has been Alina Van Omen, author of Nicaragua Must Survive, Sandinista Revolutionary Diplomacy and the Global Cold War. You can get the book via University of California Press. Thank you so much, Alina.
Thank you.